Everyone knows the phrase Achilles heel, you know, the single point of vulnerability in something otherwise really strong.
Right, we use it all the time for businesses, sports teams, whatever.
Exactly. But what if we told you that the story behind it, well, it's way more complicated than just a quick dip in a river?
And that its meaning kind of shifted even back in ancient times.
Precisely. Today we're doing a deep dive into Achilles, the legendary warrior of the Trojan War.
But not just the epic hero version.
No, we're looking at him as this dynamic figure, how his image in ancient Greek art and society really became this canvas.
Reflecting their own changing values, politics, even, and some pretty deep human stuff.
We've gone through a whole stack of fascinating sources, scholarly articles on Greek art, bits about the myth itself, how people saw him over the centuries.
Yeah, it's quite a web.
Our mission really is to peel back those layers. How did the ancient Greeks actually see his story? Was it history, myth,
A bit of both, often.
and how did artists use his legend to make points, build identity, maybe even push some political messages you wouldn't expect? Get ready for some aha moments, hopefully.
Definitely.
Okay, let's jump right in. The heel, the most famous bit.
The one everyone knows.
The story goes, he's the son of Thetis, a sea nymph, and Peleus, a mortal king.
Classic demigod setup.
And Thetis, wanting him to be immortal, dips him in the river Styx, but she holds him by one heel.
Leaving that one spot, well, vulnerable.
And that's supposedly the origin of the phrase Achilles' heel.
The explanation we usually get.
Plus, he's this half-god, super strong, trained by Chiron the Centaur in, well, everything. Warfare, medicine, music, hunting.
Quite the education.
You'd think so, wouldn't you?
It is. But here's where it gets really interesting and maybe changes things a bit.
Oh.
That whole invulnerable except the heel thing, it's not really in the earliest accounts.
You mean like Homer, the Iliad?
Exactly. Homer doesn't mention him being invulnerable, doesn't mention a weak heel, nothing.
Wait, really? He doesn't mention the heel.
Not a word about it. In fact, Homer actually describes Achilles getting wounded, like a spear grazes his elbow fighting Astapios.
So he could be hurt in the Iliad.
Yep. And if you look at early vase paintings of his death, you see arrows hitting his body, his torso, not just the heel.
So where did the heel story come from then?
It seems to really take hold much, much later, probably solidified with writers like Statius in his Achilles. That's first century CE, centuries after Homer.
Wow. Okay. So the idiom is based on a later version of the myth.
Pretty much. And if you want to connect this to the bigger picture, think about his name, Achilles.
Okay.
Some scholars think it might come from ancient Greek words meaning like grief or pain and people or nation.
So, like, he whose people grieve, or he who brings grief, something along those lines. He who has the people distressed, or he whose people have distress. It kind of hints at this deep emotional journey, you know, way beyond just being strong.
That's actually really powerful. It frames him differently from the start. It does. And he had other names too, of course. Polites, son of Peleus, reminding you of his human side.
Right, his mortal father.
And the really famous one from Homer, Podarces.
Swift-footed.
Swift-footed. Homer uses it constantly, emphasizing that incredible speed. Each name adds a little piece to the puzzle.
Okay, so his name hints at grief. His key trait is speed, and the invulnerability thing is later. Got it. And this complex figure, he famously chose glory over a long life, right?
He did. That choice essentially seals his fate and leads him straight to Troy.
He shows up with his myrmidons, 50 ships strong, the Greeks' greatest weapon.
Absolutely, the ultimate warrior.
But then, in Iliad, for a huge chunk of it, he's not actually fighting.
No, he's famously withdrawn, sat in his tent, furious.
Consumed by wrath, that's the word, isn't it?
It is. Homer's Iliad literally opens with, "Sing, O goddess, the anger of Achilles."
The anger isn't just incidental, it's the main event.
It is the main event. It's the central theme, the engine of the plot. And it explodes because Agamemnon, the leader of the Greeks,
The commander, yeah.
he takes Brisis, a captive woman who had been given to Achilles as a war prize.
A symbol of his honor, his Cleo.
Exactly. Taking her is a massive public dishonor. And Achilles' reaction, he withdraws himself and his men from the fight.
Which leads to the big question.
What happens when your best player walks off the field?
The Greeks start losing badly.
Terribly. They get pushed right back to their ships. It's a disaster. And this withdrawal, this anger, it directly causes the deepest tragedy for Achilles.
Patroclus.
His closest companion, Patroclus, he goes into battle wearing Achilles' armor, trying to rally the Greeks.
And he's killed. by Hector.
Yes.
Wow.
And Patroclus' death just transforms Achilles. His anger shifts. It becomes this bottomless grief mixed with an overwhelming need for revenge.
So he goes back to fight.
Oh, does he ever. He gets new armor made by the god Hephaestus himself. Divine armor. He becomes this terrifying force of destruction, pure of vengeance.
And he goes after Hector.
Hunts him down, kills him. But it doesn't stop there. In his rage, he ties Hector's body to his chariot and drags it around the Greek camp for days.
It's brutal. Even Homer seems shocked by it.
It's presented as excessive, definitely. Homer even suggests his rage is so intense, it's like defying fate itself at that point.
But eventually, something shifts again.
It does. His humanity flickers back. Hector's old father, King Priam, risks everything to come secretly into the Greek camp to Achilles' tent.
To beg for his son's body back.
Yes. And seeing Priam's grief, which mirrors his own grief for Patroclus, it touches Achilles. He relents. He gives the body back.
It's such a powerful moment. It shows he's not just a killing machine.
Exactly. And if you think about Greek heroes, the Hoshas, they were often demigods. Yeah, praised for fighting skill.
But not necessarily role models in the modern sense.
Not always, no. Achilles really embodies hubris, that excessive pride, that rage that goes too far and brings tragedy. He's not like, say, Odysseus.
Who uses his brain more than his brawn.
Right. Odysseus is about cunning, patience, strategy. Achilles is raw power, emotion, honor, sometimes taken to a destructive extreme.
That's a really clear distinction. So, okay, we have this incredibly complex, tragic figure from the epics. How did this story, how did he actually function in everyday ancient Greek life? Was it just stories people told?
Oh, much more than that. Myths weren't just entertainment. They were, like one source puts it, traditional tales with secondary partial reference to something of collective importance.
Meaning they carried deeper messages for society.
Definitely. But, and this is crucial, the visual art, the images, they never became rigid religious dogma.
So artists had room to play.
A lot of room. They could interpret, innovate, even add things. Remember that scene we talked about, Achilles bandaging Patroclus?
Yeah, you said it's on pottery, but not in the Iliad.
Exactly. It's like ancient Greek fan art, almost. Artists filling in gaps, creating moments that resonated visually, even if they weren't in the official text.
That's amazing. So they weren't just illustrating, they were adding to the narrative cycle.
Precisely. And that leads to something else fascinating, how they could subtly tweak perceptions, even with really famous scenes.
Like what?
Okay, take the scene of Achilles and Ajax playing a board game, Patea. It's super popular on vases.
Right, the two heroes taking a break from the war.
Yeah. On one famous vase by Exequias, black figure style, Achilles is wearing his helmet. He looks taller, more dominant. Ajax is bareheaded, leaning in.
Implying Achilles is more important, maybe?
Could be. But then you look at another vase by the Lysippides painter, also black figure. Both are bareheaded. Looks much more like equals, right?
Yeah, definitely more balanced.
And then switch to red figure technique, maybe by the Andocides painter. Both might wear helmets, but the detail is richer, the composition different.
So the artists are making choices that change the meaning.
Absolutely. Tiny details, helmet on, helmet off, convey different things. Maybe reflecting the artist's view or the patrons, or just exploring the relationship. It shows how art could shape how people understood these myths.
Which makes you wonder, how did the Greeks see the Trojan War itself?
Yeah.
You mentioned it was sometimes history, sometimes myth.
Exactly. There were sort of two main camps. On one side, loads of people treated it as real history. They saw themselves as descendants of those heroes.
Like he was their origin story.
Kind of, yeah. You have serious historians like Thucydides using Homer's list of ships in the Iliad to try and figure out how big the Greek army actually was.
Wow. Using epic poetry as a historical source.
He did. But then on the other side, you had intellectuals, philosophers like Xenophanes, poets like Pindar, who were more skeptical.
Saying Homer exaggerated? Or maybe wasn't telling the whole truth.
Yeah, criticizing the stories, maybe finding them morally questionable or just not literally true. Plato even suggested they were more about universal ideas than actual events.
So a real mix of belief and skepticism.
Definitely. But even the skeptics knew these stories had power. Politicians, leaders, they were definitely not shy about using these myths, these connections to the heroic age, for their own purposes, whether they fully believed them or not. They knew it worked with the public.
Okay, so these myths weren't just static tales. They were alive, adaptable. especially when real-world events happened.
Oh, absolutely. Think about a huge generation-defining war today. Imagine how we might start reinterpreting older stories or historical figures to make sense of it or to rally people.
Right, drawing parallels.
That's exactly what happened with the Trojan War and the Persian Wars in the 5th century BC.
Those were the huge conflicts between the Greek city-states and the Persian Empire, right? Massive wars.
Massive existential wars. And they totally reshaped how Greeks, especially Athenians, viewed the Trojan War. It became a major theme everywhere, especially in art.
So they started connecting Troy to Persia.
Very explicitly. What's really interesting is how the Athenians managed to, well, boost their own importance in the Trojan story. Homer doesn't give Athens a huge role, honestly.
They weren't major players in the Iliad.
Not really. But during the Persian Wars, you find things like an epigram on a public monument, a herm. It directly links the bravery of the Greeks at Troy with the Athenians fighting the Persians. And it specifically name drops Menestheus.
The Athenian leader mentioned in the Iliad's list of ships.
The very one. It's a clever way to weave Athenian bravery into the ancient epic, boosting their prestige right when they needed it most against Persia.
Smart propaganda, basically.
Pretty much. And in the public eye, how they saw the Trojans shifted dramatically.
How so?
They started portraying Trojans as basically stand-ins for the Persians. Eastern foreigners, barbarians. This whole Greek versus barbarian idea became super stark.
Us versus them.
Totally. You see it in plays from the time, emphasizing the huge gap between Hellene and barbarian, and art hammered this home.
How did art show that?
Well, think about the painted Stoa in Athens, a famous public building. Its paintings deliberately put the Trojan War right next to other us versus them battles, Greeks fighting Amazons and Athenians fighting Persians at Marathon.
Grouping the Trojans visually with other enemies or outsiders.
Exactly. Trojans were grouped with their Asiatic partners, as one source puts it. The Parthenon sculptures, the Mesopiacs, did something similar. They showed Greeks versus Trojans alongside gods versus giants and Lapiths versus centaurs.
Centaurs, like half man, half horse.
Yeah. Wild, chaotic, almost monstrous figures. So associating Trojans with them visually makes a powerful statement. Trojans are foreign, other, maybe even less than fully human in this context.
Wow, that's a huge shift from Homer.
A massive shift, because in the Iliad, you know, Greeks and Trojans feel pretty similar. They share customs, like guest friendship, Bansenia, Hector talks about Hades. They seem to share the same basic worldview, the same gods.
So this later view is definitely a politically motivated rewrite.
It really looks that way. A conscious reshaping driven by the conflict with Persia.
But did that view stick? Or did it change again?
It changed again. These things are always fluid, aren't they? Fast forward to the Peloponnesian War.
Athens versus Sparta, Greek versus Greek.
Exactly. Now, the enemy wasn't some foreign barbarian empire. It was another Greek state. And suddenly, especially in more private settings, the perception of Trojans seems to soften again.
Because the definition of us and them changed.
Precisely. With Sparta as the main rival, maybe those old Eastern foreigner Trojans didn't seem so bad or so different anymore. You start seeing evidence like Athenians giving their kids Trojan names again. Aeneas, Hector.
That's a telling detail.
It is. And on pottery from this period, most Trojans are depicted looking pretty much Greek. Maybe only Paris sometimes gets the Oriental treatment. Art shifts away from that stark Greek versus barbarian imagery. You see more scenes of, say, warriors preparing for battle, less emphasis on showing the Trojans as fundamentally different or unequal.
So the myths bend and flex depending on the current political reality.
It really demonstrates how these narratives were living things, constantly reinterpreted to meet the moment.
It's incredible how adaptable these stories were. But, okay, putting aside the politics for a second.
Mm-hmm.
These myths, Achilles' story, they must have hit deeper too, right? On a more personal, human level for the Greeks.
Oh, absolutely. Beyond the politics, the myth offered this sort of unified vision, as one scholar calls it, dealing with the really big stuff. Life, death, honor, glory.
The fundamental questions.
Exactly. Take mortality. Just showing scenes of war, even if they look heroic, it's still a reminder of danger, of death. It's something that could get across a message about one's own existence.
The connection to their own lives and risks.
Yeah. There's a striking red figure cup, for instance. It shows Achilles and Patroclus, both doomed mortals, alongside Heracles.
Who became a god, immortal.
Right. So juxtaposing them really highlights the hero's mortality, their ultimate fate. It's a theme you see a lot in Athenian vase paintings, since ordinary people were definitely thinking about the costs and consequences of war.
And what about honor? That seems huge for Achilles.
Paramount. Absolutely central. The classic example isn't Achilles, maybe, but Ajax. His suicide after he loses the contest for Achilles' armor to Odysseus.
Because the dishonor was too great to bear.
Exactly. His famous line sums it up. The options for a noble man are only two. Either live with honor or make a quick and honorable death. That wasn't just a poetic idea, it was a powerful ideal. And you see it depicted starkly in art, like on a black figure cup showing Ajax falling on his sword. A grim but honorable end, in their view.
And Achilles himself made that choice, didn't he? Honor over long life.
He did. The short, glorious life in exchange for Cleos for internal fame. And in a way, he got it.
Through the stories, like the Iliad.
Through the stories, absolutely. But also through actual worship. His tomb, near Troy, was a major site of veneration for centuries.
People visited it, like a shrine.
Yes. The Salians, who claimed connection to him, Persians, even Alexander the Great made a point of visiting, identifying with him. Roman emperors, too, like Caracalla.
Wow. So his fame really did last.
It did. His cult even spread way up to the Black Sea. There was an island, Luke, sometimes called Snake Island, where he was worshipped as Achilles Pontarches.
Lord of the Sea.
Lord of Pontus Exenus, yeah, the Black Sea. Seen as a protector, especially by cities like Olbia nearby. So that relentless pursuit of glory, even with all its flaws and tragedy, it did ultimately grant him a kind of immortality.
Through memory, story, and worship.
Exactly.
What an incredible arc. From a potentially misremembered heel story to a political symbol bent this way and that, and finally landing on these deep truths about being human honor, glory, mortality. Achilles' story is just this amazing case study in how myths work, how they evolve and stay relevant.
Yeah, what starts as maybe one epic tale gets constantly relayered, reshaped by every society that tells it, reflecting their own anxieties, ambitions, their art.
It really reminds you that heroism is almost never simple. And even the guy known as the Invincible Warrior was incredibly complexly human.
He really was. And, you know, thinking about how fluid that Trojan War myth was, how easily it was adapted, it does make you wonder, doesn't it?
Wonder what?
Well, how much are our own stories, the narratives we tell ourselves today about our history, our identity, how much are they being shaped, maybe unconsciously, by our current needs, by politics, by the artists and storytellers of our time?
Huh. What kind of deep dives will people in the future take into our stories, and what conclusions will they draw about us based on how we told them?
It's definitely something to think about, isn't it?
It really is. Something for you to ponder on your own deep dive. Until next time.